Australians have voted in record numbers for third parties and independents at this federal election, and that was despite a chorus of warnings about the chaos that might follow. The coalition is now likely to govern in its own right, but only just, and minority government is never out of the question when the margin is so slim. Minority governments have become commonplace, though, across many Westminster nations, where voters seem to have tired of this sort of winner-takes-all battle between two political tribes. And even though Malcolm Turnbull told us a hung parliament would bring us to, I think his words were, a grinding halt, he's moved very quickly to negotiate with the crossbenchers, and he's so far got the support of the Queensland independent Bob Katter and Cathy McGowan, an independent MP for Indi in northern Victoria, and also Andrew Wilkie from Tasmania. It will be a challenge, however, to keep everybody happy, just as it was a challenge for Julia Gillard in 2010. So is there some sort of art to a stable minority government? Let's ask Akash Pawan, author of Making Minority Government Work. His paper is part of his work at the UK's Institute for Government, a research centre for improving government. Hello, Akash.
Hi there.
And John Warhurst, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the Australian National University. Morning, John.
Good morning.
Akash, we'll start with you. Is minority government so bad, and is it unusual?
It's certainly, I think, something we get likely to see more of in Australia, in the UK, and in other Western democracies, because, I mean, what we've seen is our party political system has grown significantly more diverse, society has become more pluralistic, and we've gone from a situation where not that long ago the two large parties in Australia, in the UK, in New Zealand, in Canada and elsewhere used to win sort of 90-95% of the vote between them. Now it's way, way below that. So I think minority government or some form of cooperation between parties in order to govern in a hung parliament is just something that's here to stay.
John, do you think the warnings about this sort of ragtag militia, which is, I think, Bill Shorten's description of the independents, simply didn't resonate? Australians wanted candidates to prosecute their local issues.
Oh, absolutely. I think the talking down of minor parties, micro parties and independents by the major party leaders was just a matter of self-interest. And I think it was a self-interest that Australian voters saw through, as they are seeing through at the state level and, as you mentioned, with Julia Gillard's minority government only two parliaments ago. So it's become much more common, as Akash said, and I think the fact that neither of the major parties, at least in Australia, are setting the world on fire in terms of popular appeal. Once you get 20 to 25% of the electorate voting for other than the two major parties and you have a reasonably close race between two uninspired major party contenders, then you're going to have it happen on a regular basis. And I think voters are just not put off by scare tactics.
Akash, is 25% of the electorate voting for non-major parties, the traditional major parties, now the new normal? Is that ordinarily high? I'm not sure about where we place it in the international context.
Well, every country has a different party political system. I mean, I've looked at some of the data in this, and in the UK, for example, I mean, we used to have a very, very strong two-party system. So our Labour and Conservative parties used to win upwards of 90% of the vote. It's now down at around 65%. So, yeah, I mean, there's no kind of magic figure that you expect to see. But what you see in many countries is new political issues have emerged onto the agenda that have created new cleavages, new dividing lines, and created space for new parties to emerge.
Yeah, I should ask you both about, well, the issues that have really provoked this disintegration of the dominance of the two-party system. John, is the high vote for micro parties a rejection, basically, of the sort of post-Cold War economic world that we live in? Because let me read to you what Bob Katter said. Senator Nick Xenophon and I have never ascribed to the soulless, godless, disastrous policies of a free market economy, which has destroyed the manufacturing base in this country and the agricultural base in North Queensland. So there's an ideological disaffection here, isn't there?
Yes, I think there's an ideological disaffection as far as economic policy is concerned, and a lot of disaffection about open economies and free trade and the extent to which regional communities in particular and certain aspects of communities like manufacturing industry and some farming commodities are suffering under free trade. That's part of it. I think there's also some element of the sorts of issues which are non-economic ones which have emerged since the 1960s onwards. Akash mentioned the Greens. There's also been the Democrats in Australia and under proportional representation systems, those micro-parties that want to concentrate on non-economic issues certainly have quite a lot of leverage. We've had animal justice parties, sex parties, a variety, which have often polled quite significant but small percentages of the vote. And finally, I would add there's the regional component of it, which is more better known in Canada, for instance, than it is in Australia. But the Nick Xenophon experience in South Australia combines a number of these elements into a very regional approach. And once you can focus your vote on a particular region, you'll get better bang for your buck.
Akash, John referred there to Canada, a very similar Westminster country. Now, they've had the rise of regional parties across the provinces, but most of those regional parties that have dominated in certain provinces, whether it's been the New Democrats, which is a left-of-centre party, or even Bloc Québécois, which is, you know, Franco-nationalist, they also reject, though, this sort of neoliberal globalisation agenda in many ways, don't they?
I think it's been part of their appeal, possibly, yes. I mean, I'm not sure rejection of the sort of economic orthodoxy is the most significant factor in explaining why we have these more pluralistic systems. I mean, I think it's just a very complex phenomenon. And you know, we've just heard about the various new political issues that have come onto the agenda. And yes, certainly in Canada, in Quebec, and to some extent in the West, and in the UK, in Scotland. I mean, what we've seen is certainly the rise of regional parties that have challenged the old national party system.
What are some of the key attributes of a successful minority government?
Well, I think one of the things that's important to remember that people often overlook is that a government, simply by being the government, actually has a huge amount of power that doesn't rest on its position in parliament. So, you know, a lot of powers are exercised by ministers through their executive prerogative. Governments control the legislative agenda. They control the budget process. There's a lot that the government can do and doesn't necessarily rely upon passing bills through parliament on a day-to-day basis. So one thing it does mean, potentially, if you're in a minority, is that you may not be able to legislate as much. And, you know, possibly that's a good thing. I think we often have too much legislation in many areas. It also, of course, does mean that when governments do bring forward legislation or indeed budgets, they'll have to compromise. They'll have to negotiate concessions with the smaller parties or independents. But what we've seen in the places we've looked at is that governments tend to be able to get most of their business through and negotiate often kind of smaller, maybe symbolically important concessions around the margins of what they're trying to do. So as long as the government's got quite a clear strategic sense of what it's trying to achieve, then minority governments can be surprisingly effective.
Yeah. John Warhurst, in Australia, which party better manages minority governments? I mean, it seems to me, just looking at minority governments over the past 20 years, mainly at state level, Labor leaders tend to make a slightly better go of it in the sense that they're used to the idea of negotiating. It's in their sort of blood. When I look at Conservative governments, the premiers tend to, and the prime ministers tend to have a very sort of CEO focus. I'm just wondering, what is your view of the pattern of those governments?
I think there's something in what you say, Andrew. I think the Labor Party perhaps has more of a negotiating culture not only because of the presence of the factions, whereas with the Liberals, a lot of emphasis being put on the role of the leader, so that the leader rules, and perhaps a leader who's used to that sort of position within their own party may find it harder to compromise with those on the crossbench. But I think it's not just the difference between the two types of parties. I think there are personality differences with leaders, and good negotiators can probably be found on both sides of the party divide, and we'll see how Malcolm Turnbull measures up on that criterion. I think also it depends on the sort of minority government. Labor in Australia has often been aligned with the Greens, and that has both advantages and disadvantages in an ideological sense. And some of the other minority governments which the Liberals have been involved with have been a small bunch of independents who are a bit like herding cats, I think, a bit more difficult perhaps than dealing with a leader of a small minor party. And there's one other point I would add perhaps, and that is if you've got a wafer-thin majority, that is a minority government with just 50+1% of the vote in the parliament, then that puts a lot of stress and tension into the whole arrangement. I think Malcolm Turnbull will be fortunate if he's in a situation where he has just a couple of votes more than he actually needs, so that he can play hardball when necessary with one or two of those who are supporting him, and be all soft and cuddly with the others when he needs to.
Akash and John, isn't there always a risk, and we've only got a couple of minutes left, that when you are in these minority government situations, the minority party, which may represent a sectional interest, can leverage that to force the government to make, well, if you like, questionable investments that can often lead to sort of real economic stress and turmoil? Akash?
Well, I think minority governments have to make concessions ultimately to survive. And in politics, concessions quite often involve spending more money or providing tax breaks or something like that. So I think there can be risks that if you have a weak minority government that feels it has to keep cutting deals and doing compromising on its plans to survive, there could be a negative impact on fiscal discipline. But I don't think it's an automatic relationship. Clever minority governments can play off the different smaller parties or independents against each other. Obviously, it depends on the numbers in the parliament. I mean, as long as they kind of concentrate on the key objectives they're trying to achieve, they can keep the real concessions as opposed to the symbolic ones to a minimum.
John, yes, very briefly, I noticed that Bob Katter emerged from negotiations this week with Malcolm Turnbull saying he wanted a new dam at Hell's Gate, which is, I think, on the Upper Burdekin River. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but Bob seemed to leave that meeting with the PM convinced the dam was going to be built. So is this symptomatic of the next 3 years?
Look, it's one of the dangers, I think. It's always a very bad look if one MP on the crossbench seems to be getting a far better deal than the other MPs and electorates around the country. So I think that's something Malcolm Turnbull should watch out for. But on the other hand, I agree with the cash. You can have unfortunate compromises and decisions which are swayed by the power of one. I would have thought that there are some dangers, but they're equally to be found in other sorts of situations, including coalitions and majority governments.
Yeah, well, that's always the qualification to my point about coalition leaders having a more CEO view of their role. They do actually have to govern in a coalition. And as we've seen historically, whether it was with Black Jack McEwen or Doug Anthony, a Liberal leader has to also, I guess, be a reasonable negotiator. Look, it's great to talk to you both. John Warhurst, Emeritus Professor of Political Science at the Australian National University, and Akash Pawan, a fellow at the Institute for Government in the UK. He's one of the authors of a report, Making Minority Government Work, Hung Parliaments and the Challenges for Westminster and Whitehall. We'll put a link to that on the website. Thanks very much for joining us, both of you.
Thanks for having me.